From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Scott Tong. It's Here and Now. General Mark Milley, heroic, treasonous, somewhere in the middle. The country's highest-ranking military leader twice called his Chinese counterpart to pledge that the U.S. would not attack China. The calls came at the end of the Trump administration last October and then this January. This was first reported in an upcoming book and then confirmed by Milley and the Pentagon. Milley reportedly feared that Trump's actions in the waning days of his presidency could have provoked a military confrontation with China. His critics include retired Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, who said he crossed a line. Here he is on Newsweek's The Daily Break podcast.
Even if he did what he did for the right reasons, what he did was wrong. And there is an accountability with that. You can't just walk away from flirting with upending civil military norms, you know, doing end runs around civilian control and walk away with it. There are consequences.
Okay, let's bring in Here and Now's national security analyst, Jim Walsh, to talk about all this. He's with the MIT Security Studies Program. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Scott.
Now, there's a furious political debate, as you know, over Milley and what he did. How do you think about this and what it tells us about who's in charge, the top uniformed military officer or the commander-in-chief?
Well, you're right to say that the debate has sort of settled into Milley as heroic defender at a moment of peril. I mean, it's worth pointing out that this was in the middle of the insurrection, after all. Others saying he was insubordinate and crossed the line. And then others saying, no, you guys have it all wrong. This was normal by the book stuff. All of this had been scheduled in advance and reviewed. Regular communication with a nuclear-armed country to prevent misperception, miscalculation, and that's a good thing. And Scott, I don't think you'll be surprised to hear that I have a contrarian view. And that is that this all misses the point in a deeply disturbing way. The point is, and it had been true for some time, that many people appointed by Mr. Trump came to fear that he might act rashly and cause or start a war, even a nuclear war. So these are his people, officials in national security who know him best, and they're the ones who are the most worried. Now, you know, we can have a debate over whether, in fact, lines were crossed or they weren't and what the proper procedure is. But, hey, let's just pull back here and say the people who knew him best in national security were worried he was going to start a nuclear war. And we're all sort of like, well, that's crazy. But, hey, what about those North Koreans? So I think we're missing the flashing sign here that there's a problem, and the problem is nuclear weapons.
And as far as flashing signs, there were, of course, two calls. And as you say, one came January 8th, 2 days after the insurrection at the Capitol. Do the events of that day, House Speaker Pelosi reportedly talking to Milley about Trump's state of mind and Milley talking to senior officers about nuclear decision making. I mean, is this one of those specific days that goes exactly to what you're talking about?
Yes, I think so. I remember that day so well. It was a Friday when Pelosi announced that she had talked to Milley and asked him about what had gone down. And in all the reporting that we've had this week, no one is talking about that. So on one single day, January 8th, Pelosi calls Milley worried about nuclear weapons. Milley allegedly reassures China that there'll be no surprise attack. And on that same day, Milley convenes his senior officers to review the procedures for proper nuclear decision-making. Now, am I supposed to believe that that's all a big coincidence? No. People were genuinely scared about what Trump might do. And that's because we have all these weapons. It was a flashing danger sign, and we were sort of concerned about it, but then we all moved on.
I mean, is there an alternative way to look at this and say these could be people at very high levels, but they were overreacting to what was happening?
I mean, that could be, but, you know, who should we be if they're overreacting? It makes me wonder how we should be. If they're the closest to the situation and the people who know the president the best and take nuclear weapons seriously, most of us don't have time to think about that sort of thing. That's their job. And if they're freaking out about it, then that tells me something very wrong is going on. And if you remember, Scott, in that whole run-up, that last half year, from September on, there were people who were being relieved of duty. Esper was brought on. He was fired. He was on travel the whole month of September because he didn't want to have to deal with it. There were people who were temporarily acting positions. I mean, the whole process, decision-making process, was all broken down, and then in the middle of this, you get the insurrection.
Right. And very quickly, I just want to come back to this debate very quickly. On one hand, there are those who say, the military leaders can take charge in a case like this, and others who are absolutists, who say civilian control over these things. Is that, in your view, a legitimate debate out there of how to do things?
In some ways, yes, absolutely. And I am not saying the military should take charge. I believe in democracy, and I believe in, strict rules for civil-military relations. Okay. I'm saying that the military was scared to death. And that the problem here is not one person. The problem is that an American president or a general or any other single human being has the power to destroy everything on Earth because they control nuclear weapons. So the problem is not the person. It's that one person has the ability to destroy everything. The problem is not the system. It's the nuclear weapons.
Okay. All right. Jim Walsh, here and now, is National Security Analyst at the MIT Security Studies Program. Jim, thank you as always.
Thank you, Scott.
Travel to the United Kingdom just got a little easier. The British government announced it will stop requiring double vaccinated people to take a PCR test before returning from many countries. Meanwhile, the race is on to get the number of cases of COVID-19 down in the UK before we enter the winter months. That's when people typically spend more time indoors and in close proximity to others. Prime Minister Boris Johnson earlier this week praised how much vaccines have made a difference, and he wants to continue that momentum.
COVID is still out there, but I'm confident that we can keep going with our plan to turn jabs into jobs, and protect the gains that we've made together.
I spoke earlier today with NPR's London correspondent Frank Langford and asked him to explain Boris Johnson's plan to avoid a hard winter.
What's interesting, Tanya, listening to that clip, that is, he wants to jab his way out of this. There's no question. He's talking about just continuing to vaccinate. 4 out of 5 people over 16 here are already double vaxxed. So it's actually been a very good effort. They want to extend it. They're in the process of extending it, I think, to 12 to 15 year olds. And then I think we're going to see boosters beginning next week for people over 50 and other people who are vulnerable. Now, if that doesn't work, he's talking about mandatory vaccine passports for mass events and other kinds of settings, face coverings legally mandated in some places. These, of course, though, I mean, these are mild measures to what we had before in this country. What's clear is Johnson does not want to close down businesses again. Also should note that Johnson only controls England. There are 4 countries in the United Kingdom, and other countries have different policies. So, for instance, Wales is going to require COVID passes to get into soccer matches and nightclubs.
The percentage, 66% of the population in the UK is fully vaccinated. If we put that up against the United States, we're only at 54%. What are some of the social and maybe political challenges in the UK to getting more people to actually get the shot?
I think that's one of the things we're going to continue to work on this fall. But I got to say, vaccine hesitancy is much lower here than it is in the United States. I say that as somebody who spent 5 weeks in the U.S., over the summer, and I ran into a number of people. I did know people who were anti-vax, and I've got to say, here in London, I only know one person who's my next-door neighbor who is anti-vax, and of course, the figures also, when you look at surveys, also reflect this. So it's actually considerably easier for Boris Johnson than it is for President Biden, and we do have anti-vax protests here, but they're not representative. They're loud. There's certainly lots of people in the streets, but they're not really representative.
You've been traveling recently, as you said, to the United States and to France. What has it been like moving back and forth in your travels? And what have been the biggest differences in that experience that you've noticed?
It's been fascinating. The United States was a little more difficult in terms of getting, you have to get pre-boarding. I'm double vaccinated, but you have to get a PCR test before you board, and then you have to have PCR tests before you come back. And then it ends up being quite expensive. I mean, I think I end up spending a few $100 for members of my family to do this. Now, what's interesting is last weekend I went to Paris, and it was much easier. France is very heavily vaccinated, and you didn't need a test to go in. The other thing that was fascinating is they do have vaccine passports, basically, in France, so that if you want to go to a museum, you have to show your phone and have them scan it. And then for people who aren't double vaxxed, I'll give you an example. I was at the Musée d'Orsay, and they had a tent, and you could get a lateral flow test. So they were handling it in a very, I think, a clever way.
Can you talk a little bit about the economics of easing international restrictions? Because unlike say, traveling from the United States to another country. You know, when you travel in Europe, it's like going from state to state. I mean, I can imagine that economically, this is a major driver to ease restrictions and to get people
vaccinated. The travel industry has been brutalized in Europe. And so that easing is very important. And I think one of the things you're seeing right now is the pressure to ease restrictions is coming from ordinary people who want to travel and also are tired of paying for a lot of money for tests that they're not sure are all that, frankly, helpful in terms of public safety and public health. And then the airline industries who are just like, you know, are we going to be able to hold on if we continue to not be able to fill up planes and to be able to move people across, you know, onto the continent?
That's NPR's London correspondent, Frank Lankford. As always, thank you so much, Frank.
And thanks for having me, Tanya.
And that's it. It's over. This historic 2020 NBA championship belongs to the Los Angeles Lakers. The Lakers conquer the bubble, and banner number 17 will soon hang in the rafters.
Remember the bubble? The NBA pioneered the method of quarantining back during the 2020 season. Teams were locked down at Walt Disney World in Orlando. It was so successful, they applied lessons learned to this latest season. And now a new study is using data from those two seasons to better understand the coronavirus. For more, let's bring in Brandon Ogbunu. He's an assistant professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at Yale. And he wrote an article detailing the study for the publication The Undefeated. Brandon, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. Now, this bubble, it wasn't perfect, but it actually worked. Can you give us a quick rundown of what those two seasons looked like for players and staff?
Yeah, I think overall, the bubbles were a large success. They were able to kind of complete two seasons in the midst of the pandemic, and there were different challenges during the two seasons. Of course, the first bubble was the true bubble. That was a real experiment in epidemiology where it was organized in a way such that there was going to be contact between players because, of course, they're playing each other and they have to kind of maintain this level of interaction, but very limited contact between individuals from kind of outside the bubble, you know, the world, and individuals within the bubble. And that really was a triumph and was successful. Now, in the second season, they decided to not use the bubble model, and I don't think anybody wanted to. They tried to get back to some semblance of business as usual with regard to traveling, but they did structure things in terms of the schedule, shortening the season, traveling was kind of organized in a way to try to limit multiple contacts between teams within a certain week. And while there were a lot of infectious events, they were none that required that they suspend play at all, and they were able to complete their season on time. And so the second season should also be called a success.
Let's talk a little bit about what their hypothesis was. What questions were they trying to answer as they were researching these two seasons that you know, the greater public can use?
Most recently, findings from the NBA were able to kind of help us understand some things about the way that the Delta variant of concern, how it is transmitted, the fact that it can infect individuals who are vaccinated is something we suspected, but the NBA provided this really important test case, right? Because these are all healthy individuals by and large. And so the hypothesis, you know, that they tested was, you know, could the Delta variant, could that can be transmitted between vaccinated and unvaccinated individuals? And it can. Mm-hmm. But critically, vaccinated individuals clear virus from their body faster. So the vaccine, it kind of doubled down on this notion that the vaccine really is one of the most, you know, the most important thing we could really be doing to control SARS-CoV-2 transmission, even in the wake of the Delta variant.
It's so interesting that they were able to pinpoint this, right? They were able to support that original theory that the Delta variant creates greater amounts of the virus as well.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What is the next step? Where is this data being used to inform how the nation is responding to the Delta variant?
Well, if you think back to the original bubble, I think the NBA really delivered to the world the first bit of information that if you put kind of responsible and cutting edge science central, you limit contacts between individuals, you can actually successfully carry on a workplace. And I think that influenced the way a lot of kind of workspaces were constructed, like, you know, universities where I work, for example. But I think the general message of the importance of the vaccine is something we see now emphasized in the NFL. Even though requirements haven't quite, been the talk, I think certainly strong encouragement has been the language across sports leagues, certainly in the, in universities where, some people are requiring vaccines. So the importance of the vaccine has been supported by the NBA data and just mindful and smart public health practice in general, limiting contacts, being responsible, even amongst vaccinated individuals. I think that is, the message is an important one and is one that will kind of frame the next generation of approaches for thinking about a post-Delta world.
Brandon Ogbunu, Assistant Professor of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at Yale. Brandon, thank you so much for laying this all out for us.
Thank you for having me and have a great rest of the week.
In our chase for innovative, high-tech ways to address climate change, we sometimes forget about a very low-tech way to remove carbon dioxide right in our yards and our playgrounds. Trees.
So my favorite tree here sequesters approximately 166.3 pounds of CO2 annually. So that's quite a number just for one individual tree.
Danielle Ignace is a Harvard Forest Research Associate. She's standing next to a gurgling river and under a big old sugar maple tree that's three, maybe four stories high. Now, trees alone can't absorb all the CO2 being emitted from our fossil fuel burning, but they are a vital carbon sink, as the scientists call them. And trees are cleaning and cooling the air in Ignace's yard through their leaves. WBUR's Martha Biebinger picks up the story.
The sugar maple takes Ignace back to childhood summers, playing in the woods. It's the leaves in particular that she has always loved.
They almost remind me of a heart shape, and so I just thought they were really beautiful.
There's another tree rooted in Ignace's early memories, the Douglas fir. Their majestic peaks spread across the Coeur d'Alene Reservation in northern Idaho. Ignace is a member of the tribe. Early in his career, her father was a firefighter.
Wanting to protect Douglas firs, and I'm realizing now that perhaps that was always ingrained in me from my father and how important those forests were.
Now, as a scientist who studies trees, Ignace appreciates the beauty of her leaf's machinery as well, and the surprising ways it contributes to our health. Like cleaning our air, the surface of this maple leaf is covered with tiny pores that pull in carbon, ozone, and other pollutants.
And so, yeah, plants are amazing air filters, in a sense. And leaves themselves can capture particle matter as well.
Those flecks of chemicals and debris that can inflame our lungs get caught on the fibers of the leaf as pollution moves through the air.
Trees have a really unique ability in certain situations to help us deal with that.
The thousands of leaves on Ignace's tall maple are also mini air coolers. Her tree draws water up through its roots and sends it out into the leaves. The millions of pores release tiny puffs of water vapor.
Not as good as an air conditioner, but I'll take it on such a hot day.
That vapor and vast canopy of shade keeps a stone patio near this tree and the air around us about 10 degrees cooler than in Ignace's sun-baked driveway. In the midst of all that cleaning and cooling, this maple is also performing a feat science is struggling to recreate. It's a carbon-guzzling factory. The maple leaves fluttering above us aren't just sucking carbon out of the air. They're turning that carbon into sugar and using it to grow.
We can think of this as everything from the trunk to the branches and the leaves to roots.
Trees build with carbon that would otherwise add to the blanket of greenhouse gases overheating our planet. And right now, Ignace's sugar maple is pumping.
This large sugar maple is very active right now. We are in the middle of its growing season, so we're approaching its peak activity for the year.
There's a lot of talk about planting new trees to fight climate change. Ignace agrees that we need more trees. But preserving those we have now may be even more important because it could take decades to reach the cleaning, cooling, and storage capacity of this sugar maple.
Yes, we want to make sure that if these trees are healthy, that we want to keep them intact.
That means managing threats like drought and development. Reducing gas leaks can also help save trees. To show the value of even a single tree, Ignace pulls out her phone and goes to a site called iTree. It's a tool developed by the U.S. Forest Service and others that estimates the cleaning, cooling, and other benefits of an individual tree. Here's the carbon storage capacity for Ignace's sugar maple.
It calculates that there's a lifetime CO2 equivalent of carbon of 22,049 pounds.
That's the carbon released by 1,100 gallons of gas burned in an average car.
That's quite a feat for a single tree.
In the race to slow climate change, the Biden administration, as well as leaders in Peru, Canada, Costa Rica, and many other countries, are investing in trees and other so-called natural allies. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland made the case at an international summit earlier this summer.
Nature provides us with solutions to the climate crisis. Achieving net zero by 2050 will not be possible without nature.
Climate experts say preserving forested areas, as well as your favorite tree and mine, is among the critical steps we must take to tackle climate change. For Here and Now, I'm Martha Biebinger.
Next week, Martha reports on the mental and physical health benefits of trees and the access to them in one Massachusetts neighborhood.
All right, we need your help with a story we're working on. What's your relationship with the dentist like? Do you love it, hate it, really, really hate it? The reality is a lot of people are afraid of the dentist, more than a quarter of the population. So we want to get to the bottom of why and what can be done to help. Because as the experts tell us, dental health is tied to so many other health outcomes. Tell us your story by filling out our form at hereandnow.org or drop us an email at letters@hereandnow.org. In Del Rio, Texas, more than 10,000 migrants, mostly Haitians fleeing natural disasters, are camped out underneath a bridge that serves as a port of entry between the U.S. and Mexico. The situation is chaotic. The small border town is trying to manage the growing numbers in over 100-degree weather. Here's the mayor of Del Rio, Bruno Lozano, at the bridge yesterday, talking about the strain on Border Patrol.
The Border Patrol right now is so overwhelmed with the influx of migrants in the Del Rio sector. We have about 2,000 to 3,000 at any given moment in detention. These individuals behind me are not in detention. They're just waiting to get detained.
For more on this, let's bring in Nick Miroff, immigration reporter for The Washington Post. Nick, good to have you with us.
Good to be with you.
Nick, why are so many camping out at this bridge in Del Rio? Who are they?
So thousands of migrants have come across really in the last 3 days. Most of them are Haitian migrants. They are part of a larger wave of Haitians who have been coming up from South America over the past couple months. Many of them are Haitians who left their country after the 2010 earthquake and made it to South America. And they are on the move again. And coming to the United States, and really just in the last few days, we've seen this incredible mass crossing into that Del Rio camp.
Governor Greg Abbott said he was going to shut down the ports of entry because Customs had requested their help. Customs and Border Protection said there was no such request. How are local officials there in Del Rio responding or helping these people?
Local officials there are pretty alarmed. They have been trying to get the Biden administration's attention for several months, warning that the, you know, increase in crossings this year has become unsustainable, that it was a big drag on local resources. And one of the challenges to that Del Rio area is that in contrast to other parts of the border, say, like the San Diego area or the lower Rio Grande Valley, the Del Rio area doesn't have a lot of NGOs or groups that are used to accommodating bringing relief to these kinds of large crowds of migrants. And so there's a very acute need. It's much greater than something that local organizations can respond to. And really everyone down there from the city and local officials to the U.S. Border Patrol is calling for help and trying to get the administration to send more resources and more personnel.
With that, what kind of challenges does this bring to the Biden administration? If these local officials have been trying to get the attention of the administration for a while now, I mean, they've already struggled to respond to the backlog of applications and the influx of migrants at the borders.
We're in a moment at which illegal border crossings are at a 20-year high. More than 200,000 migrants taken into custody in August for the second consecutive month. So the Biden administration and the U.S. Border Patrol are already overwhelmed at the border. And on top of that, the administration is trying to resettle more than 60,000 Afghan evacuees who have been arriving after the fall of Kabul. And the fear is that this camp is likely to grow. There are many thousands more Haitians and other migrants who are in this pipeline and who are likely to try to cross there in the coming weeks.
That was Nick Miroff, immigration reporter with The Washington Post. Nick, thank you so much for this update.
Good to be with you.
Weekend Update with Norm MacDonald.
Norm MacDonald died this week at 61 after a long battle with cancer. The Canadian comedian spent decades behind the mic, a skilled deadpan, and at times controversial performer, perhaps most remembered for his roles on Saturday Night Live as Burt Reynolds and the host of Weekend Update. MacDonald brought fake news to viewers long before the term took on its current meaning. But after he left the show mid-season in 1998, his popularity waxed and waned, something he was acutely aware of. In 2016, MacDonald released a fictional memoir called Based on a True Story with the hope that it would revive his career. Our colleagues at the WBUR podcast team and the Washington Post caught up with him back then for the podcast Edge of Fame. We wanted to bring you an excerpt from that interview, taped just before the comedian was scheduled to appear on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon. Reporter Jeff Edgers has the story.
From Studio 6B in Rockefeller Center in the heart of New York City, it's The Tonight Show starring Jimmy Fallon.
Hey, 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 hey!
I called up Norm a couple of days before his appearance because I wanted to interview him a little bit on the phone before he went on. Instead, he says, hey, why don't you just come? So I did. I got on the train and headed to New York. Met Norm for lunch and had my recorder with me.
So this is the floor, huh?
This is the sixth floor.
Yeah, Tonight Show.
Where Johnny Carson started.
When we arrived at Rockefeller Center, we headed straight into Steve Higgins' office. Higgins has been a writer for Saturday Night Live for years. He's also Jimmy Fallon's sidekick. And hearing Higgins, you know you could tell that he's glad to see Norm's out of the house.
Well.
Look who it is.
This guy here.
Come back from the dead.
Yes, don't we know this room?
Hi,
Steve.
Are you?
Good to see
so I get in there, and it's kind of amazing. For now, I'm standing there with the recorder over my chest when Jimmy Fallon walks in.
How great, by the way, is your book?
Woo!
Based on a true story.
Oh, it's great.
When he approaches Norm, it feels more like he's just a big fan, like a young kid on Saturday Night Live looking up to one of his idols.
Do you remember the first time I actually met you? Because I met you like through Sandler or something. I'm the biggest fan. But you were at Bel Air Hotel, maybe having breakfast with Bob Newhart.
Oh, yeah.
And you were sitting with Bob Newhart, and I went over to your table. I go, oh, my God, sorry to interrupt, but Norm MacDonald, you're like one of my idols. You're my favorite comedians. You're the best.
Yeah, you saw Bob Newhart.
Yeah, you go, hey, what do you say? It's Bob Newhart. Like, I was like, oh, yeah, no, you're great. Of course, you're great, too, Bob Newhart. But,
damn, I never heard
thanks for
that.
The bit tonight. That's going to be
oh,
great.
It'll be fun, right?
Oh, I'm
yeah,
so excited.
Yeah, I think it'll be fun.
Because he's doing this whole thing where he's going to bring
his health records.
Yeah. It's such a good bit.
It's going to be great.
And I don't know the joke, so I'm just going to read it off the paper.
Oh, okay, cool.
You know, you're more overdue. You're more than always welcome on the show. We love you, man.
Thank you
and
so
Fred
much.
Fred Stoller.
So much thanks,
Jimmy.
It's very nice meeting you.
Pleasure. Oh, my God. Pleasure.
I'm so excited.
Before I tell you what happens next, there's something you should know about Norm. Sometimes he has problems with basic sorts of tasks. Like you go to buzz in at his door at his condo and it's sort of like a comedy of errors. Keeps pressing the button at the wrong time or doesn't know exactly what number for you to call. His mom, who still lives in Canada, would tell me that when he was on SNL, you know, making a lot of money, she would call up his apartment and sometimes wouldn't be able to get through because the phone had been disconnected. Norm just forgot to pay the bill. And in this case, Norm maybe needs someone to hold his jokes. Because when he gets to The Tonight Show, he can't find him. the sheet of paper is missing.
Where am I?
Where'd you put it?
I just don't want you to lose it.
I can just use a dialogue.
I don't know. I just had it.
You just have it.
How did I lose it? It's in the book, I bet.
But what I've learned with Norm is not to worry. Just let it be. Be the ball, right? And so he goes on The Tonight Show without his jokes. And somehow, they emerge. I don't know if it's spontaneity or that he just remembers them, but he makes it work.
I saw, you know, Mr. Trump is here and he's on Dr. Oz and he released his medical records. So I decided, as, you know, entertainer-in-chief... I decided that I would release my, I think the American people.
Oh, my goodness.
Deserve to
Absolutely,
know.
Absolutely, yes. Now, you don't have to do this, Norm.
I know, but I feel that it's my duty. Now, I will say I'm a little nervous because I have not looked at this. My doctor gave it to me directly before the show.
And it's a sealed envelope.
Yes. I can attest that Mr. McDonald's blood pressure is an astonishingly excellent 120 over 80.
Hey, fantastic. That's great. That's good.
Mr. McDonald has the physical endurance of 10 men half his age.
Whoa, my goodness. This is unbelievable.
Mr. McDonald's spleen is, I want to say, good.
Your spleen is, okay.
It was successful. Everything went well. But now Norm is trying to hustle to the airport when he realizes he's misplaced his wallet. Several people are crouched on the sidewalk looking for it. His producing partner, Lori Jo Hoekstra, his comedian friend, Fred Stoller, and finally, success. Lori Jo finds Norm's wallet.
Everything's okay now, right?
All good. Good to go.
I'll see you next week, okay?
See you next week, pal.
Good job.
The life Norm leads these days is pretty unglamorous, at least by Hollywood standards. He lives in a condo near the Los Angeles airport. He's divorced. He spends a lot of time alone. He watches sports and news and tweets and he writes. I watched him work on his fake memoir, comic novel, whatever you want to call it, for months. And when it finally came out last year, he invited me to interview him on the stage in Washington, D.C. at the cultural center called Sixth and I. And when I showed up, the place was packed.
This chapter you're going to read to us, it's called a Tiny White Coffin, right?
It's called Tiny White Coffin because one time I saw a tiny white coffin and it struck me as one of the saddest images I'd ever seen. So anyways, it's about a child. When you're a celebrity of any sort, people want things from you. Especially terminally ill children. So anyways, there was a Make-A-Wish Foundation, and this child wanted me, he wanted to come to SNL.
Natural.
And watch me throughout the week and see how an idea became a sketch. And I was saying how touched I was that he wanted to do that. And then he said, I don't want to do that. I just made that up. I haven't liked SNL since Bill Murray left. So I said, well, what do you want me for? He said, well, do you have your Canadian citizenship still? And I said, yes, I'm Canadian, you know. And he said, well, that helps my wish. My wish is to kill a baby seal.
So clearly this isn't true. I don't believe that Norm took a young child out into the wilds to kill a baby seal, but it got a good laugh. But there was another section of the book that I really wanted him to read. To me, it's maybe the most honest and true section you can find. It's about him staring in the mirror and his view of himself. I mean, this part really choked me up when I first read it.
When people come to see me do stand-up, it is because somewhere in their memory, I live on SNL. Dressed as a young Burt Reynolds, insisting Alex Trebek refer to me as Turd Ferguson. And they come to see me, and I am old and fat, and I don't mention SNL, and I do my answering machine joke that always does well. And they are happily disappointed, and after the show, they stand beside me and take pictures, the way you would with a donkey at the side of a road. They tell me they are big fans, and they don't care what their girlfriends say. The only thing an old man can tell a young man is that it goes fast, real fast. And if you're not careful, it's too late. Of course, the young man will never understand this truth.
That was comedian Norm MacDonald. Our story was reported by Jeff Edgers for the podcast Edge of Fame, a co-production of WBUR and The Washington Post.
Germans go to the polls later this month in an election that will shape the future of Europe's largest economy. Chancellor Angela Merkel is stepping down, and we have NPR correspondent Rob Schmitz to tell us about it from Berlin. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Scott.
Angela Merkel, at least from far away, has been the steady symbol of post-Cold War European values. I mean, for 16 years, mm-hmm. to put a point on it, she took the job before the first iPhone came out.
That's right.
Why is she stepping down now?
Well, you know, she actually wanted to step down before Germany's last election in 2017, but she reportedly reversed that decision after Donald Trump won the U.S. presidency. Would have left her as one of the world's last torchbearers for liberalism in the West, and she wanted to make sure that she stuck around. When she finally announced she would step down in 2018, her party had just had a very poor showing in an important state election, one of the party's traditional strongholds. And she commented at the time that things within her party needed to change, and she, as chancellor, was one of them.
Speaking of her party and where it is now, in Germany's parliamentary system, of course, the voters pick parties, not a chancellor directly. The leading party in the polls is the Social Democrats, and they have candidate Olaf Scholz. Who is he, and what's on his wish list?
Olaf Scholz is a career politician. He's 63 years old. He's a former labor lawyer who grew up in Hamburg, Germany's largest port city. He was actually mayor of Hamburg for 7 years, and he's credited with solving a thorny housing crisis in the city by initiating a building boom, which transformed Hamburg into a tourist destination. He served as labor minister during Merkel's first term as chancellor, and now in her final term, he's serving as finance minister. He's also been a member of parliament for decades. He's been referred to in the German press as the German version of Joe Biden. He's someone who's given his life to serving in the government. He knows how to make a law. He knows how to get it passed. He knows how to keep an economy together. And he knows how to build a coalition.
So a very known commodity. Meantime, right. Angela Merkel's party, the more conservative Christian Democrats, for now at least, are slipping. I mean, they ran Germany for a whopping 16 years. Why are they sliding in the polls?
Well, one problem is the candidate they chose. Armin Laschet, who leads Germany's most populous state, is, to put it mildly, not a popular politician. He's temperamental, he's seen as arrogant, and he's made big public gaffes during his campaign. The worst one was in July, when during a speech by Germany's president mourning the victims of the floods that month, Laschet was caught on video in the background laughing. But these errors in judgment are the least of his problems. I spoke to Heinrich Wefing, managing editor of the political desk at German newspaper Die Zeit, about this. And he says a bigger issue is simply filling the shoes of a larger-than-life chancellor.
His key problem is that he represents the party and a government that has been in office for 16 years now, not under his command, but under Angela Merkel. So arguing that change is necessary puts him in a very difficult spot.
Well, meantime, of course, these past 16 years, a lot has changed in the world and a lot has changed for Germany. So what are the kind of big issues you hear voters talking about now?
Well, I think the biggest issue when I speak to voters is Germany's economy. Germans are worried about the pandemic's impact on the EU's largest economy, and they want to ensure that jobs aren't lost as we go through what is now a fourth wave of the coronavirus. The environment is also a big concern. More than 180 people died as a result of horrible flooding in July that was brought on by climate change. So ensuring that Germany is reducing its carbon emissions and preparing for future climate-related disasters is really important for German voters.
Yeah, and very quickly, can we talk for a moment about Angela Merkel's legacy? I mean, what will her lasting legacy be, you know, to her supporters and to her detractors in the next few years?
Well, Merkel has left Germany better than she's found it, and she's been a very popular chancellor. And I think whoever is the next chancellor will find it difficult to step out of that shadow. That's not a bad situation to be in because they're inheriting a country that's doing quite well right now, but it's going to prove to be a challenge for whomever prevails on September 26th.
Now, Rob, there are several other parties in the running here, and no matter who takes the top spot in this election, they're going to have to form some kind of a coalition with other parties to govern. How might that shake out?
Yeah, it's not going to be quick and easy, and that's because no party has, at least in the polling numbers we've seen so far, a clear majority. Whichever party receives the most votes will likely have to form a coalition with not just one other party, but at least two other parties in order to form a new government. After the last election in 2017, it took Angela Merkel months to do this. And this time around, it's expected to take a long time, too. So it's likely that Germans will get to hold on to Chancellor Merkel for months to come as all these parties try to negotiate with each other.
NPR's Rob Schmitz in Berlin. Rob, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.